This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Next, we'll speak with law professor and director of the Gillis Long Poverty Law Center at Loyola University, William Quigley. You and I know some of the 15 million Americans who couldn't care less if we eventually have to put Saddam and Osama's pictures on the side of milk cartons. Those people, our friends and neighbors, whose priorities are very much in order, represent the 9.1 million Americans who have recently lost their jobs, combined with the already unemployed and underemployed. In July, the U.S. economy lost a net 44,000 private sector jobs, according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. Since the current administration took office, we have lost to other shores 3.2 million private sector jobs. In the manufacturing sector, 2.5 million jobs have drifted to other nations as well. To those whose unemployment insurance is about to run out, it matters very little whether we've gotten even, gained control of Hussein's oil fields, or begun a 21st century empire. They simply want to work, to contribute, to be independent, and to cover all of their own family expenses. Our trade policies have made it more profitable for U.S. firms to move plants and jobs outside our borders. Minimum wage workers haven't seen a pay increase since 1997, and in June, we hit a 10-year high in the unemployment rate, as 6.4% of us went job hunting. So is it time to make the right to a job at a living wage an amendment to the Constitution? William Quigley, professor of law at Loyola University in New Orleans, sees our Constitution as our communal list of promises to one another. He makes a moral case for making the right to work and the right to fair compensation a part of our Constitution. Kathy Golden speaks by phone with William Quigley.
Bill, you have taken the trouble to start out with the basics, which is defining poverty, and I guess no one much agrees on what that is.
Well, you know, the government didn't really come up with a definition of poverty till the 1960s, and they took a very conservative and very simple approach to poverty, essentially said, figure out how much it costs in groceries that a person wouldn't starve to death in a month, and then multiply that dollar figure by three, and that's really what the poverty line was when it was first created, and it's just been adjusted for inflation ever since. And as a result, the official poverty line, of which there's tens of millions of people who are below it, is actually much below what I think most people believe real poverty is, which the definition that I use and most folks use, poverty means that you have to depend on somebody else to make it. And what does it actually cost for a family or even a single individual to live? And if you're talking about ending poverty, you have to first figure out what poverty is. And if you're going to be real about it, then you need to talk about how do we get to the point where people don't need soup kitchens or food stamps or governmental or family assistance to be able to make it. How can people get to a position where they can be independent, support themselves, take care of their families on their own? And that's really addressing poverty. On any given day, there's about 10 million people in this country who are officially unemployed, don't have a job at all, and another 4 or 5 million who haven't had a job so long that the government doesn't really count them into that figure, or who are working part-time and would like to be working full-time. So you start with about 15 million people who really don't have a job who would like to work, and there are an additional 30-plus million people who earn less than $8.20 an hour, which is still a couple of dollars over the minimum wage, but you know, is still not in the area where you can expect week in and week out that you can pay your bills most of the time. You add those two groups together, you're talking about 50 million people in this country who either need a job or who are working full-time and are just not making it. And that is a very significant number. And there is sort of an American consensus that people who want to work should have the right to have a job. And there is agreement that people who work full-time shouldn't really be poor. And this book documents those facts and tells some of the stories of a number of the people who are in those situations and then says, well, if we believe that we should do something better, and we got 50 million people who are not making it, what can we do about it?
And it seems theoretically there certainly is enough resources and enough money and enough wealth to go around, to be shared. Why do we never really escape poverty?
Well, serious economists and the like say, as you said, that there really is enough to go around. It's the question about how it's distributed. And in the United States, we really prize the opportunity to work and the opportunity to succeed, but at the same time, we don't really have enough community spirit to recognize the human dignity of everybody and say, look, we have to sort of bend and shape the economic system so that there may be not so many people who are making millions and millions of dollars every year, and maybe more people who are making $25,000, $30,000 a year. And we have some great things going on in the United States, these living wage campaigns that are going on in dozens of cities around this country have been a great educational tool about how much it really costs to live and how by a small change in some of the city laws that some people can earn a living wage who didn't earn it before. It really is what we believe, that everybody should have a right to a job, they have a right to work, and that they should be able to earn a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. FDR said that in the 30s very explicitly, and most people agree with it, but we've sort of been sold this bill of goods that the current economic system won't let it, that interfering with the so-called free market would be disastrous, and that's just not at all the case.
Is that how we get to end poverty? I mean, do we have to legislate the right to a living wage and a job?
I think that we do. The minimum wage, $5.15 an hour. It hasn't been raised for several years. And even the most radical proposals to raise it, talk about raising it a dollar over 2 years, which is still going to leave it several dollars short of what it actually costs for a living wage. I think the minimum wage ought to be replaced with a minimum living wage, which for a single person I think is double what the minimum wage is. You have to make $10 an hour in order to really be able to buy food, get shelter, take care of your health care needs, get back and forth to work, just the basics, pay your utilities and the like. And then if you're supporting a family, then you're going to need a couple of bucks more an hour for each one of those folks involved. And I think we amend the Constitution to guarantee every person the right to a job and the right to earn a living wage if they work full time. And I think, in my way of looking at it, our Constitution is sort of like our community promises to each other. We promise, like in the era of free speech, we promise to try to work to make sure that the government doesn't infringe upon our speech. We promise to try to work against racial discrimination, promise to try to work to get everybody the chance to vote. And because they're in our Constitution, they're one of the things that we continually work on. And I think that most people in America do believe that people should have the right or an opportunity to work themselves out of poverty. And so I think putting it in our Constitution would enable it to stay as one of like the top 10 things that we work on all the time. That's the reason for proposing it as a constitutional amendment. And I would just mention that I do have a website, www.endingpoverty.com, that has links to a lot of organizations so that people can do some follow-up work on that. But there are the beginnings of this discussion, but we're really, really at the sprouting part of the idea.
Thank you so much for speaking with us on Ending Poverty as We Know It by William P. Quigley, and it is a Temple Press publication.
Thank you all.
As a nation and as individuals, have we become too comfortable with debt? Let our producers know what you think. Log on to the Voices of Our World webpage, www.maryknoll.org. There's a spot there for your feedback. It's no accident that we're the home of the sponge hand, index finger pointed toward the sky. U.S. sports fans wave that finger, chanting, "We're number one! We're number one!" in stadiums across the country. We are used to thinking of ourselves as top dog. But not so fast. Apparently, when it comes to the quality of life issues, we may be slipping. Here's Sally Shelley with the United Nations Annual Human Development Index report. Sally?
Each year, the United Nations issues a Human Development Report, which includes an index of countries with the highest standard of living. The criteria are length of life, which equates access to health facilities, adult literacy, an indicator of education, percentage of school enrollment at three levels, likewise, and average income, that is, gross domestic product, divided by the number of people. This year, Norway again held first place, while Iceland moved up five places to second, followed by Sweden, and then a newcomer to the top four, Australia, moving up from fifth place to fourth. Fifth was the Netherlands, sixth was Belgium, the United States dropped from sixth to seventh place, and Canada, which for many years was number one, dropped down to eighth, followed by Japan, also a former leader, and Switzerland. Switzerland is a newcomer to the top 10, which joined the United Nations as a full member last year. In our studio is British economist David Stewart, who worked on the report. We asked him to tell us why the United States, which has the highest per capita income, dropped down a point.
Even though the United States has a very high income, it has lower levels of life expectancy and of school enrollment than some other countries that are above it. The reason why it dropped this year was really because other countries moved up, such as Iceland.
The UN's development report also has a graph showing which countries have the largest percentage of poor people in their population.
There are 17 countries, and coming in 17th is the United States. That's about 1 in 6 live below the poverty line. But if you have the average income in the United States, if you're below half of that, you're considered poor.
On the bottom of the list are 22 African countries south of the Sahara. They have been there for several years. Muslim countries to the north of Africa have a higher standard of living. Mr. Stewart comments.
Not all the problems in Africa are conflict and bad governance. These are very important factors, but a number of these poorest countries are facing obstacles which they're really struggling to overcome on their own. One of the biggest ones is HIV/AIDS. Life expectancy, for example, in Zambia has dropped from 50 years, which it was 20 years ago, and is now at around 30 years. So it's absolutely devastating.
Zambia has also lost 2/3 of its teachers to AIDS. Several countries in Africa suffer from lack of access to ports.
Having access to ports is absolutely vital, and you find on average, it's the small countries who are locked away from ports who are performing much worse than countries who do have ports, for example.
At the Millennium Forum, the United Nations adopted a goal to raise half the poorest in the world from $1 a day to $2 a day by 2015, and the goal will undoubtedly be met.
In China, what you see is that since the 70s, there have been huge increases in life expectancy and education indicators, and it wasn't until the 80s that that then converted into these huge surges in income. China has been growing at about 8% a year. It's lifted 150 million people out of income poverty since 1990. It is a huge development success. Since September the 11th, there's been a much greater focus outside countries' own borders. People are looking beyond their own borders more than they have done, I think, in generations. And there's been a focus on the war on terror. What this report hopes to achieve is to shift some of that emphasis onto the war on poverty and make people realize the enormous suffering there is in the world and how there are solutions to these problems. Well, I think one of the things this leads on to, which is very interesting, is the importance of gender empowerment. Because what you find as women become more educated and are more empowered in the decisions that affect their lives, it leads to highest child survival rates as decisions on child health and family health become better. So a very important focus for development is on empowering women and achieving gender equality.
This is Sally Swing Shelley reporting from the United Nations.
Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Michael Hudson, William Quigley, and David Stewart are just some of the voices of our world. Voices of Our World is a presentation of this station and Maryknoll. Our producers are Kathy Golden and Eleanor Ostrinsky. Our executive producer is Larry Rich. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. To find out more about the issues discussed on today's program, here are some websites for you. For Bill Quigley's book, go to www.endingpoverty.com. For Michael Hudson's article, Banking on Misery, go to www.southernstudies.org. And other sources include United for a Fair Economy at www.ufe.org. If you'd like to receive a free 3-month subscription to Maryknoll Magazine in English or Spanish, call 1-888-MARYKNOLL. That's 1-888-MARYKNOLL. If you have questions about Maryknoll or our program, call 1-888-MARYKNOLL. If you missed a portion of the show, just catch us on Maryknoll's website, www.maryknoll.org. And please be sure to join us next time for more Voices of Our World.